We're going to call the third general session of the Fall 2006 Convention of the California Council of the Blind to order. All right. Before I turn it over to the to our presiding officer for the afternoon, I just want to make a few announcements and an introduction. This person is no stranger that I'm about to introduce. Our audio person, Rick Acacian, has been with us now. I think this is his third convention. And I haven't introduced him yet. I want him to say a few words, but I got to tell you, Rick was supposed to have an assistant, and shortly before the convention, the assistant sort of had to bail. And so Rick has been running around single-handedly doing an incredible job. Let's hear it for Rick. Rick is going to be heading off in another career direction. He's going to go into teaching soon, but we're hoping to have him one more time at our next convention, hopefully, to help train someone to carry on with us. Rick is just an amazing guy and a super guy to work with, and we have so few problems. It's just incredible when Rick is handling the mics for us. So let's hear it one more time. And Rick, can you say a few words?
Thanks, Jeff. You kind of surprised me there. Thanks. A lot of things worked out well this time that it's making it a lot easier for me. This hotel has apparently managed the rooms in such a way that I'm able to do a lot more in the same amount of time. They've managed to put some rooms back to back that where I otherwise would have had to run across the hotel and up and down floors and stuff. And things have worked out really well at this hotel, and I'm very impressed. Maybe it's a fluke, but it worked really well. So I have to give a lot of credit to that and to Ed, who managed part of that, too.
Okay. So, thank you very much, Rick. Again. Okay. All right. Now I want to turn it over to not only an outstanding CCB member, but a wonderful, wonderful friend of mine and colleague in my chapter, former chapter president, and just an incredible person. And my daughter likes her, although she much prefers her husband. I want to introduce Rhonda King, CCB secretary.
Thank you. I'm really, really kind of nervous about this because I've never done this. It's going to be my first attempt at presiding over one of the general sessions. So I hope all of you can bear with me. Can you hear me? I say this is the first time I'm presiding over one of the general sessions, so I'm really nervous about it, and I hope that I can do this as well as others have. So if I make any mistakes, just bear with me. And I want to thank Jeff for the kind words, and mostly because I was holding a gun to his head. But he is right about his daughter. She swears that she's going to take my husband away from me someday when she grows up. And I haven't told her yet that she's welcome to him. No, not really. No, not really. I'm only kidding. That's a keeper. Anyway, we're going to start today. I'm going to start with the invocation. And our reverend today is Reverend George Thomas, and he's with the New Name Missionary Baptist Church here in Los Angeles. Can we welcome him, please?
Thank you. Let us bow our heads. Father, our God, creator and our maker, but Father, this whole wide universe, oh, Lord God, we come now thanking you for your many blessings that you bestowed upon us. We thank you, dear God, that you allowed us to be here one more time. And we ask you to continue to bless those, Father God, that are here, those that are coming, and those that are in charge of this great movement, Dear God, has shown their love and their support. We ask you to bless each and every one that's on this council, those that are on the staff and those that are participants. Give them the strength, dear God. Bless their families that they may be able to come together and stick together, dear God. And we ask you to bless all these your people. Give us the strength that we so desire to need right now, Father God, because we need you and we realize that we can't get along without you. We ask you, Father God, to touch us now and lead us and guide us the way that you want us to go, dear God, and hold us up. And give us that strength that we so desire to need. In the name of the Father, Son, and of the Holy Spirit. And every heart said, amen.
Amen.
God bless you.
Thank you, Reverend, for the kind words. And
bless
may
you.
God bless you also. Okay, we're going to be doing the Pledge of Allegiance. So at this time, I want to say, too, that we're going to have the color guard here this afternoon, but they're not available. So we're just going to go right into doing the Pledge of Allegiance, and our pledge leader today is Andy Baracco from the Greater Los Angeles Chapter. Andy, are you up here?
Yes, I'm. Okay. Yes, I would like everyone to rise and to face forward. I do not believe we have a flag, but we do?
We don't.
Oh, we don't, right. Okay. Okay, so rise and face forward and repeat after me. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Thank you, Andy.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, our first presentation today, which Jeff is going to announce, comes to us from the Francis Blend School for the Blind, actually School for the Visually Impaired, in Mainstream. Okay, go ahead, Jeff.
Okay. Thank you, Rhonda. The California Council of Blind has a long, long relationship with the Francis Blind School for the Visually Impaired. Many of you, my wife included, so I hear all about it all the time, are alumni of this incredible school. And today, whenever Francis Blind has needed an ally at times, CCB has always been there to help in the struggles that occasionally occur, sometimes for its very survival. So we are pleased to have with us today the principal of Francis Blend, Nancy Cohen. Ms. Cohen is a graduate of UCLA with a BA in pre-social welfare and a minor in art history. She earned her general education teaching credential from Mount St. Mary's College and a Master's of Science degree in Special Ed from USC. Ms. Cohen also has a Learning Handicap credential, an Administrative credential, and a Resource Specialist certificate. She has taught in the LA Unified School District since 1971. Don't want to date yourself like that. I do that all the time as well. She taught elementary grades in the Opportunity Room, as well as being a special education day classes and resource specialist classes for over 18 years. In addition, she was a program specialist for special education in the district office for 2 years, and an assistant principal in charge of special education at a general education school for 3 years. She has currently finished her first year as principal at Francis Blend School for the Visually Impaired. And now I give you Ms. Nancy Cohen.
And
Jeff, we can't hear back here.
Okay, good afternoon. Can you hear? Yes. Everyone can hear? Good. Okay. Thank you for that very nice introduction. As Jeff said, I am the principal of Francis Blind School, and this is my second year as the principal.
I am very honored to be speaking to you today, and I appreciate your support. As I understand through the history, you've been very supportive of the school. Today, I'm going to tell you about the mission of our school, a little bit about our history, some of our mainstream practices, our goals for the year, and I'm going to give you an idea of a typical day at the Francis Blinn School for the Visually Impaired. First of all, I'll start a little bit with our mission. In 1915 in Los Angeles, a teacher named Francis Blinn became the first principal of the blind and sight-saving school in Los Angeles. And this school was located at the current site of the 32nd Street School in downtown L.A. near University of Southern California. In the early 50s, the name of the school was changed to the Francis Blinn School because of this principal. She was one of the first teachers of the blind students in Los Angeles, and then she became the principal, and the school was named for her. In 1960, the school moved to its present site in Hollywood. And originally, the school served students whose main disability was visual impairment. And most of the students were academic and able to be successful in the middle schools and the high schools. The population has changed a lot over the years. In the early 70s, when IDEA passed, the federal law offering many services for students with multiple disabilities, the population of the school changed. And this summer, I visited the Perkins School for the Blind, and that's the same thing that happened at that school. With the school, the population became filled with students who had visual impairments as well as multiple disabilities. The mission of the Francis Blinn School for the Visually Impaired is to prepare its students to be successful in the 21st century. The students will learn the skills that they need to enable them to reach their highest potential academically, socially, and vocationally. Our students also will learn to communicate successfully so that they can advocate for themselves and so that they can live as independently as possible. That is the mission of our school. Currently, we have 13 classes at our school. We have about three academic classes, and the rest of the classes are for students with multiple disabilities. Francis Blinn School is a Title I school. We receive federal funding. And also, about 60% of our students are English language learners. Students are bused to our school from all over the school district, and also students from neighboring school districts also attend our school. So we have many students on inter-district permits. We are the only day school for blind students in the United States. All of the rest of the schools are residential. That is the difference in our school. So our students every day are bused to school, and then, of course, they're bused back to their home, and they live with their families. Most of them do anyway. In an effort to prepare our students to be successful in the 21st century, we began mainstreaming our students to our neighboring school, Van Ness Elementary School. Van Ness Elementary and Blinn are right next to each other. We actually share a campus. We have a hallway that is shared by both of our schools. We started with group activities such as school assemblies, special events such as rock climbing. Our students did rock climbing last year, which was unbelievable. We also got a new playground at Francis Blinn School last year, a special playground that was designed just for our students. And we had a very large playground opening. The students from Van Ness Elementary School, our general education school right next door, participated in our opening ceremony. They escorted our kids and they sang with us, and it's a wonderful combination. We've conducted staff development workshops with the teachers at Van Ness Elementary, and also we are working collaboratively. We have a lot of knowledge and information to share with each other. Some of our older classrooms are going next door to work with the upper grade classrooms to study social studies and science, and also to just to have some social gatherings with the general education students. We also have field trips together, and we celebrate special holidays together. My goals for Frances Blinn for this coming year are new, and there are some really important things that our school needs to do. First of all, we're working on developing school-wide consistencies in relationship to the instructional curriculum. All of our academic classrooms are working on student monthly progress reports, and we are collaborating with the general education curriculum and with the students next door. We want our students to be successful in the mainstream. We're doing something called vertical teaming, which means that students in the lower classes work, the teachers from the students in the lower classes work with the teachers in the middle and upper grade classes, so that we set standards and we determine skills that the students need to master before they go to the next grade, right, so that we can maximize the instructional program and push the students as much as possible. Also, this year, we have started a parent center. We have a classroom that is dedicated to a parent center. And we have started parent support groups for our parents. Every Wednesday morning, we have a clinical psychologist come to our school and talk with our parents. We are offering workshops on many different subjects, and many of those subjects will be determined by the parents and their needs. We are also writing a parent center grant so that we can get equipment for the center, and my hope is that the center will be run mostly by the parents, because I feel that parents need the opportunity to be leaders in the school setting. We're also working on a school parent compact, where the parents are asked to read to their sons or daughters every day at home for about 15 minutes and then talk about a story that they've read to their child. We think that this is so important, because reading is such an important area that needs to be explored, and not just at school. It needs to be worked on at home as well. And we are very firm believers in reading every day. We want all the parents to do that with their children. And it also develops the important relationship between the parent and the child. It makes the child's success much greater when children are read to at home. Another thing that I'm planning on doing is developing a horticulture center. When I visited the Perkins School for the Blind, I saw a wonderful center that they've developed in the last, I think, 5 years, and I hope to do that. We're starting to lay the plans for that center, but we want our students to explore planting, to smell the plants, to feel the plants, to grow wonderful plants, to cook with the tomatoes or whatever we grow, and we think that's a wonderful area that needs to be explored. Also, we want to develop a tactile museum, which I also saw at the Perkins School for the Blind. That was just unbelievable. And they had all kinds of animals, animal skins, and all kinds of three-dimensional statues and all kinds of buildings and the space center and many different things. And we want to make sure that our students can work with these objects. I'll give you a little idea of a day at Frances Blinn School. The children come on the school buses from all over the city. Most of the buses arrive between 8:15 and 8:30. So this is actually one of my favorite times of the day. I love to go out and greet the children in the morning. They're so full of hope and they're smiling, and it's just a wonderful way to start the day. We have wonderful students at our school, and they have such cute personalities, and they're just so positive, and I really love that about the school. So the children get off the bus, and a lot of them walk independently, and then we help some of the little ones go and get their breakfast and carry their breakfast to their classrooms. So from about 8:30 to 8:45, the students eat breakfast, and we try to use that time for the teachers to talk with the students and develop some of their conversational and social skills. Then after that, we have reading. Most of the classrooms have reading. We have open court reading, which is the district reading program, and the upper grades concentrate on reading for 2 to 2.5 hours, which is a long time, but we have a lot of students that are very capable. We then have about an hour to an hour and a half of mathematics after recess. We have ESL for English Language Development, and we have Into English, one of the special programs, and that's another extension of reading, but it's also for students who do not speak English as their first language. After that, in the afternoon, we have social studies, we have science, we have a science teacher that goes to many of the district science meetings and brings back all the information for our students. We do social studies, we have art projects, and also this year, the district is finally paying for one day a week for the music teacher for all of the special education schools. Music is a very important component of our program. We have the music teacher once a week, but we also have a lot of assemblies where the children sing, they make costumes. Last year we had several plays that the children performed, and we like to emphasize music, theater arts, and all those kinds of activities because we think it's really good for the students. Some of the classrooms that are at a little bit lower levels who don't follow the core academic program of the Los Angeles Unified School District follow a program which involves daily living skills and vocational education skills. Our students have job tasks, we're calling them this year, where the teachers determine different tasks for the students to help them develop. And we prepare these ahead of time, and we continually change them based on the student needs. So we have boxes of different tasks in them, and they're all set up for the students. They're also based on the students' IEP goals. And so we are pushing our students as hard as we can to help them gain as much knowledge as they possibly can so that they can be successful as independent learners and successful in their later life. Let's see, some other things that we're doing. We are having, we're planning a Halloween parade next week. Many of our students will wear costumes, and it's a really fun day. A lot of parents come to the school, and the neighboring school has some classes that come over and watch our parade, and it's a lot of fun. Also, we're planning our winter program, which will probably be another play. Last year, our literacy coach wrote a play based on one of the books that the students were reading in the library, and it was wonderful. It was really well done. In all of our holiday activities, we include all of our students. Every single one of them gets to participate. Let's see, we will be having, later on, we'll be having different holiday celebrations and ethnic celebrations such as Asian. We'll have an assembly on the Asian culture. We celebrate all different cultures in our school, and we invite the parents to participate. We have a wonderful library at Francis Blinn School. We have a very devoted librarian, and every child gets to go to the library every single week. They check out books, and also the librarian goes to the classroom and reads the students' stories. So we're really big push on reading and literature. Let me see. This year, we were very fortunate. We have a math coach and a reading coach. And we have an amazing team at Francis Blinn School. We have all the same opportunities that the general education schools have. And I think this is very, very important for our learners. So if anyone has any questions, I would be happy to answer them. And I...
Okay, if we have...
I have one,
questions?
Actually.
Okay, Jeff.
I'll start off. Thank you, Madam Chair. We're always concerned about the needs of parents and about the climate between the parents and the schools, and we're glad to see that in your remarks today you've addressed some ways in which you hope to make things better for parents. But we were concerned about some of the material we read, which leads us to believe that there was somewhat of an adversarial climate between some of the parents at Francis Blinn. And I would like to know if you could address whether or not you believe this climate has improved over the last, say, 6 months.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Kathy.
Let's see. The thing that's happened lately at Francis Blinn is there's been a change in administration. That is always a time when there's some adversarial comments and sometimes a difficult climate in the school. Also, there were some problems when LA Unified was trying to include all the special schools with the general education schools. And I think there was a lot of concern about that. And also some parents still feel that Francis Blinn may not last that long because of the fact that there's such a push towards mainstreaming. So I think these are some of the issues that parents have been very concerned about, and we are working hard to address those issues and to reassure parents that our school is here to stay. I mean, I know that for sure. And that the district is supporting us very strongly and sees the need for our school. So I think these are some of the things that parents have been concerned about.
Madam Chair.
Yes, thank you. Hold it. Rogers first and then
right.
Whoever is in there. I'm sorry.
Hello.
Yes.
I wanted to say that among the things that we have tried to do to support Blinn over the years was an award which we gave to Joy Efron a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to claim authorship of the term mindless extreme inclusionism, which was in that award plaque. I just wanted you to know that. But what I really want to ask you is about expectations. I'm concerned that the appropriate expectations are given to or are held for the students, for each student. And I know that's what the IEP process is supposed to do. But I'm on an email list around my own eye condition, which is Leber's congenital amaurosis, and a lot of parents on that list. And they talk about how special educators often try to steer their children into special ed or IEP diplomas instead of real high school diplomas that'll get them into college and so forth. And I think that's a major concern, and that it's really important that the teachers themselves and special ed folks, especially, I think part of it is special ed folks that aren't specialists in blindness, actually, don't get into this low expectation syndrome where, an IEP diploma is just fine. If the kid is academic, he ought to be challenged academically and and ought to get a real diploma.
I totally agree with you, and that's why we are really boning up our instructional program so that all of our students will have a chance to compete in the general education schools. Every child who can will be given that opportunity, and I'm very much in favor of the diploma, high school diplomas, as opposed to completion of study.
I'm curious to ask a question regarding...
Can you state your name when you please
sure.
come to the mic?
This is David Jackson.
Okay.
I'm curious, where is Braille instruction and where is writing? Are you, when you're teaching the children, are they getting enough Braille and are they learning how to write? So much of society, if you want to go anywhere in the society, you have to write. And I was concerned about that. Thank you.
I think that's a very legitimate concern. And that is why this year we've developed the student monthly progress reports. And we are at, and in that report, we are asking for a sample of the student's writing. We are emphasizing Braille reading and writing. As one of my assistants who's here now will attest to in his classroom, we have a we are pushing reading and writing, not just oral instruction, because I believe that without Braille, our academic students will not be able to succeed, and we have to have that in our school. What did you say, Keith? That's right. Keith is an assistant in my school, in the highest academic class in the school, and every single day I go in there and I see his students brailing and reading and writing, and everything has to be, there has to be something that's concrete for the students. They can't just hear it. They have to produce the work.
Yeah. Barry Brown, Redwood Empire. Curious as to the age range and the number of students, and are they also being taught to use computers?
That's a good question. Okay, our students, we have a pivot program once a week at our school, one morning a week. We also have two classes of preschool students. We have two classes of kindergarten students, and then the rest of our classes go up to sixth grade. And in terms of the computer program, we have JAWS at our school. We have a computer lab, and many of our students are working with the computer teacher on a weekly basis. So we're really pushing that. We also, what, Keith? Braille notes. We also have IntelliTools, which is a new program that's coming out, and we had an in-service at the beginning of this year on IntelliTools, and we're teaching our teachers how to use it with the students.
Hi, my name is Barry Powers from the Inland Empire. You said you have 13 classes. Did you mean classes of individuals, or do you have 13 different subjects, or is it a combination of both?
Well, it's an elementary school, so we actually have 13 classes. Each class has 5 to 10 students in it. So we have we do it by age level, age and grade level. We have pre-K, we have 2 pre-K classes, 2 kindergarten classes, then we have a couple primary classes, we have intermediate classes, and we have upper grade classes. So they teach all the subjects in each class.
Okay, thanks. Is there anybody else that has any questions?
I have a comment if somebody can repeat it, because...
Okay, I'll have Jeff do that.
I'm loud enough that hopefully somebody will hear me. I just want to say to you that I am, for one, so pleased to learn that you are pushing Braille. And you know, and we all know everybody wants to work, everybody to need Braille. But I want to compliment you on what you're doing, and we've always helped. And you'll find that just as we will go out and fight when we think something's wrong, we will be there to help you. If you keep on doing what it sounds like you're doing, I bet we're all going to want to continue to help you.
Yay!
Thank you.
I don't know that that needs to be repeated, but I will repeat it. Kathy's comment essentially was thanking Nancy for the fact that they are pushing Braille because of how important it is, and reassuring her that we will, of course, always be there to help Frances Blinn when it's doing the right thing, and it appears to be doing many of the right things right now.
What?
So,
okay, upper grade, and then I want to make a comment about what Jeff just said also. Thank you very much for that comment. I have a very positive attitude, and I think that is permeating the school site. I've read a lot about students with visual impairments, and as I said, I visited the Perkins School for the Blind, and I feel that I'm pretty aware of the needs of the community, and I'm going to do everything I can to make our students successful and be able to compete with their non-disabled peers, because I think that's the most important part of our school. We want to give these kids a chance that some of them maybe wouldn't have had if they're not given the opportunities to learn programs such as JAWS, Brailing, and all of these special skills that they're going to need to compete. We also work very closely with the VI, Visually Impaired Itinerant Program, which is housed right on our school site. We have about 800 students who are in the general education schools, and they have resource rooms in the schools as well as itinerant teachers. We just got a new resource program right next door at Van Ness Elementary. So we're getting a lot of help from Van Ness, and because it is a general ed school, and We're trying to help our students mainstream. And then there was another question about upper grade classrooms. That it's really based on age. It's more the students. We have students 9, 10, and 11 year olds, and even some of them are 12, and those are our upper grade classrooms. It's really determined by age and capabilities.
Okay, we want to thank Nancy Cohen for being here today, and
thank you.
And we're really glad that she and her staff are, you know, care about the concerns of the parents and the students alike. And we would also like to mention that if any of you or anybody you know has any concerns about, you know, the Frances Blinn School or anything, feel free to use CCB as a resource to, you know, locate or, you know, find information that's needed or required out there. So our next presentation today is titled Strategies to Assist Visually Impaired Pedestrians. And we're going to be hearing from Ryan Snyder, who is the president of Ryan Snyder Associates, who is also with Los Angeles Walks. So let's welcome Ryan Snyder today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Before I dig in, there are a couple people that I've worked with in the past. I'm just curious if they're here. Bonnie Elliott from Santa Barbara. Is Bonnie here today? Okay. When I produced a pedestrian master plan for the city of Santa Barbara, Bonnie was very helpful in working with us in making sure that the needs of visually impaired people were factored into our plan. And Carl Sheege, is he here? Carl? Hey, it's great to see you, Carl. I've known Carl for a long time, and following up with the education discussion we just had, Carl not only got through high school, but he got a master's degree in urban planning at UCLA, the same school I went through, and so he's a really great model. And really nice to see you, Carl. It's been a long time. I am a planner, and I do a lot of transportation planning. And in the past several years, there's a new emerging field of pedestrian planning that I've been involved in. So that's what I'm primarily doing now is planning for pedestrians. as a consultant to cities and counties and other public agencies. I'm also a member of LA Walks, which is a member of America Walks. And I've had special training in pedestrian planning for people with disabilities from the Association of Pedestrian and Bicycle Professionals and Federal Highway Administration with help from the U.S. Access Board. So it's an issue that I've been following for a while. And just by way of background, there's a growing need for planning for disabled pedestrians. About 15% of all Americans have some form of disability. 7% of them have one disability. About 8% have two or more disabilities. And nearly everyone is disabled at some point in their life, either through injury or illness. And we have about 6.3 million Americans with sensory disabilities, either visual or hearing. And we also have a growing senior population. The demographics of our nation is changing. A growing senior population. People are living longer, and we're having fewer children. And so the need for planning for disabled people is growing. About 41% of all seniors have a disability, and 16% of seniors have a sensory disability. So this is something that's going to be with us, and the need will grow. Now, as a planner, we have to think about who we're planning for and what special needs there might be. And the things that I'm going to list here are things that you are all too familiar with, but it helps me to put them in this perspective. We have to plan for people who have maybe limited or no perception of the path ahead of them, or limited information about their surroundings if they're at a new place. Perhaps changing environments create special challenges for people. Lack of non-visual information. If you're walking down the street and you can't hear certain things, there might be not be enough information. And an inability to react quickly. Unpredictable situations like intersections, for example, that are not at 90 degrees. Things that we need to plan for. Difficulty distinguishing the edge of the sidewalk from the street. Compromised ability to detect the proper time to cross the street. And of course, this can be especially challenging when we have certain things like right turn on red. Compromised ability to stay on the correct path when crossing a street or even on the sidewalk. And perhaps a little bit more need for more time to cross the street. Removing movement barriers like difficult terrain, uneven sidewalks, discontinuous sidewalks, or other obstacles. We have to think about information barriers like the lack of color or texture contrast on streets, signals, and with different phases. We have to think about planning for users getting around construction sites. And we have to think about planning for different types of users. We have to think about partially sighted and fully blind. We have to think about those with dogs and those with canes. So taking all of these things into account, when we plan for pedestrians, all of these things are considered. And by the way, this is taking in context of the sort of pedestrian planning that we're doing today. By the way, a fairly new field. I mean, we've had sidewalks, and in some ways we've planned for pedestrians for many years, but the actual field of what we now call pedestrian planning hasn't been with us really more than 10 years or so, and really within the last 5 years is taking off. And so when we're planning for pedestrians, we think about all types of pedestrians, all people. We're thinking about seniors who have special needs. We think about children. We think about disabled people. We think about able-bodied people. And when we can plan for the most vulnerable, certainly the walking environment improves for everybody. And so what we're trying to do is incorporate all these concerns, not as add-ons or something that we think about later on after the infrastructure's in place, but we think about all of these things as we are planning, so they automatically get integrated. It's called universal design. So that's sort of the direction we're headed. Now, what are some of the things that we're doing as planners to plan for the sight impaired? And the things that I'm going to list aren't exclusively for the sight impaired, all of them, but many of them, as I said, help all pedestrians. And as we plan for all pedestrians, some of these help visually impaired as well. We need to complete our curb ramps and make sure they have the detectable warnings, truncated domes. And we have to make sure that they're following the federal standard, which is color contrast and textured contrast, with the truncated domes of the right height and texture. We need clear paths on sidewalks. We need to make sure that there are no protruding objects. We have to have conveniently located walk signal push buttons. And in areas where we have high pedestrian traffic, we're trying to get rid of the push buttons altogether. You shouldn't have to push a button to get a walk signal. Push buttons that are 2 inches in diameter, so they're large and more easily seen. And texture and color contrast in crosswalks. Now, this is something that is rapidly evolving in pedestrian planning. Within the past years or so, 10 years or so, it's become popular to have textured crosswalks. We're seeing a lot of sort of red brick or stamped asphalt in that sort of crosswalk. But those are not very visible to motorists. And they're difficult with people on wheelchairs. And so what we're encouraging engineers that are designing crosswalks to do now is to make sure we're using the bright white stripes, alternated 2 feet wide with 2 feet in the middle, that are much more visible. Not just your double line, but the bright white stripes are much more visible. If you want to beautify your crosswalk with texture or color, put it on the outside. And in this way, they're smooth in the middle for people in wheelchairs. They provide texture as a bit of wayfinding for visually impaired people on the periphery of the crosswalk. So, and this is something we're recently finding. I mean, the idea of a colored crosswalk was very popular a few years ago, and we still see a lot of cities putting these in. But, I hope that in the coming years we'll start to be a little smarter about how we do that. We're seeing a lot of the reds and the grays and things like this, but these are not very visible. If we're going to use color at all, make sure it's a sharp contrast so it's easily seen. And if we're going to use texture, put it on the periphery of the crosswalk. We can still get some beauty that way, and it serves functions that way. We need bright walk and don't walk signals. Locator tones on push buttons. Tactile arrows on the pedestrian head button, so you can sort of get some directional information. And then we've got our audio/vibro-tactile signals to help you cross the intersection, tell you when it's safe to cross. Of course, I think we're all familiar now with the cuckoo for north-south and the chirping for east-west. And, of course, now there's this new technology where we're using words. And I'm just curious, if I could see a raise of hand, how many of you prefer the cuckoo chirping over the words? Okay. And how many of you prefer the actual words, somebody speaking? Okay. Or actually, it's not somebody, it's a machine speaker. That looks like about 80% or so prefer the words that give you more information to say it is now the correct time to cross Colorado Boulevard northbound. Okay. Well, that's some technology that is evolving. And in the whole field of audio pedestrian signals, there's a lot of changes happening right now as we discover and learn more about preferences and how these devices can be used. By the way, audio pedestrian signals are required at every signalized intersection in Australia. Seems like something we could eventually do here. In Australia, audio pedestrian signals are required at every signalized intersection. that's standard, just a standard part of a signalized intersection. Of course, now we've got other devices. There's vibrating devices now. We've got having the person carry a receiver with information on the crossing and point it at the pedestrian head, where they point it at the pedestrian head and get some information. We're looking at something called audible beaconing, which produces a sound from the opposite side of the street to help you understand the clear path, the direct path to the other side of the street. And special buttons that give people more time to cross. If you push this button, then the signal knows that somebody needs a little bit more time. There's another version of this called the Puffin Crossing, another acronym, Pedestrian User Friendly Intelligent Crossing. It's called the Puffin Crossing, and we have some signals that are named after birds, and this is one of them. It's something that detects a pedestrian in the crosswalk, and it holds the walk signal and the green light until the person has enough time to get across. Visually impaired people need help in complex intersections. We need to understand that intersections that are not at 90 degrees, or maybe have, instead of four corners, maybe they've got five corners or something like this, these present special difficulties, and some special wayfinding information is very useful there. We're starting to put tactile maps on of crosswalks at intersections, so that before you cross, you can feel the complex intersection and sort of get a map of it and understand where the intersection might take you. There's another device we're using for all pedestrians called the leading pedestrian interval, which means that the pedestrians get a walk signal before the motor vehicles do. And it gives them a couple seconds head start, gets them in the intersection, and the motorists can see them when they're pulling into the intersection. We also need standard sort of markings and signings and technology. If you're in the same community and there is technology for visually impaired people, it needs to be consistent so that people understand, get used to that technology and understand it. If we have one type in one intersection, another type in another section, it may not be so clear. We need good street lighting, and all pedestrians need this. We also need our crosswalks to be well lighted. We're doing more and more in slowing cars down. It's called traffic calming. This helps all pedestrians. Cars just go so fast, and there's some clear research on physics about how long it takes a car to stop when they're going 20 miles an hour versus 30 versus 40 miles an hour, and also the impact on the pedestrian if they're hit at 25 miles per hour. You have a pretty decent chance of being all right. If you're hit at 35 miles per hour, your chances go down, and if you're hit at 45 miles per hour, most likely it'll be a fatal crash. So if we can slow cars down, there's a lot of things we're doing with curb extensions and things called chicanes and just timing signals differently and a whole range of traffic calming devices that we're now starting to use. Tree grates on sidewalks are very important. And this is standard technology, again, for visually impaired, but for everybody. I know I've twisted my ankle. I'm sighted in tree wells before. They're something that are very necessary. Curb extensions are something that's a very valuable tool we're using to help pedestrians cross nowadays, sometimes called, curb extensions, and then there's another one called bulb out at the intersection, where we actually extend the curb out about 6 feet into the intersection. So it allows the pedestrians to get into the intersection more and still be protected by the curb. It allows pedestrians to be much more visible to the motorists, and it allows the pedestrians to see the motorist much better. It also dramatically shortens the distance that you have to cross, and they allow time, or they slow cars down, especially those that are making right turns. And the other thing they do is give us the geometry so that we can put in what we're calling perpendicular curb ramps that aim directly across the street instead of what is most common, the diagonal curb ramps that kind of aim towards the middle of the intersection. So, and it's the direction we're headed with curb ramps. I'm sure they help visually impaired people. They're especially valuable for people in wheelchairs to shorten the distance you cross, but also to make sure that it's clear which direction you're headed. Refuge islands are another technique we're using, particularly at locations where we've got multi-lane streets to cross and there's no traffic control. In other words, no stop sign or no traffic signal. We can use refuge islands at signalized intersections as well, but they're most useful where we have no signal and a pedestrian has to cross four lanes of traffic without the help of a signal. With a refuge island, you cross two lanes at once. You get a little island in the middle. You can take a break. You can make sure you've got a safe crossing to the other side where you just have to cross another two lanes. So those are very valuable. Good sidewalk maintenance is important. You know, a lot of cities in California made the mistake a number of years ago in planting ficus trees, which they grow fast, they're leafy, they're pretty, but, you know, as we now know, they lift up sidewalks. I didn't fully understand this until I took a vacation in northeast Queensland in Australia and went hiking through a rainforest where there were a lot of ficus trees growing natively, and I can tell you that the root systems on those trees spread way out. And so now we're left, not only ficus trees, but others, we're left with inappropriate trees that lift sidewalks, and cities have this massive problem in dealing with sidewalks that are uplifted, and they lack funds to fix them. But we're getting smarter with that too. We're not planting certain types of trees now, and we're putting root containers in when we plant new trees along sidewalks and some other things. But we've sort of have this problem for the meantime and what to do about sidewalks that are not well maintained. Where we've got construction site, we need well-designed barricades that provide some visual information, color contrast and so forth. And there was another issue that that has, you know, recently been brought up with the onset of cleaner fuel vehicles and hybrid vehicles, electric vehicles, and so forth. That the hybrids, of course, are the most common. That when they're not using their motor, they're very quiet, and they don't provide much non-visual cue for visually impaired people. What to do about this? I haven't heard any real good solutions to this one yet, and I did talk to the U.S. Access Board about this to see if there was anything new on this, but what they told me was the National Federation for the Blind is having a conference to investigate this issue on November 4th. So that's coming up very shortly, and it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that. So we're constantly using new technology. There's a lot of technology out there that we can use, and we're constantly learning more about this. And so now what do we do to make sure that some of this technology is put in place and that our walking environment becomes safer? There's a number of advocacy efforts. I'm sure you're involved in some advocacy. America Walks has been involved with this, and America Walks has conferences, and certainly the issue of universal design is a big part of what America Walks advocates. America Walks makes sure that it's in contact with the best experts in these areas, folks like Janet Barlow and Judy Coach Smith from Washington State School for the Blind. Leah Thebo from the U.S. Access Board and others are advisors to America Walks. And America Walks has Sue Newberry, an ADA expert, on their board. And, of course, there's a campaign called Complete Streets Campaign. This is a national campaign that America Walks and others are involved in. It's something that's really important. There's a coalition building. And I really believe that this is the way to go. Pedestrian advocates have common interests. Different groups have common interests. We have ADA interests, but there's a whole lot of other people, too, who want pedestrians, have safer environment for pedestrians. We've got health advocates who are alarmed at the skyrocketing rates of obesity and the consequential diabetes and heart problems that go along with that. They are now advocating healthy communities, which are communities where people can walk and bicycle and get around without having to drive. There are environmentalists that are trying to create similar communities. There are people who are advocating this, what's called the Complete Streets. There's a Complete Streets campaign that says streets are for everybody. They are not just for motor vehicles. They are for motor vehicles, but they're for buses. They're for people on bicycles. They are for pedestrians. They are for disabled people. And every street needs to think about all users as we design them. And so this Complete Streets campaign is gaining some steam now, too. LA Walks has been somewhat inactive, sometimes active, but it's promoting the idea of the city of Los Angeles having a pedestrian master plan. And the city probably will get a master plan before too long to have a new director of the planning department. But getting cities to have pedestrian master plans is very important, because in the pedestrian master plan, there's a lot of things that they can do for visually impaired people as well as other pedestrians. We're also seeing this whole field emerging that's called smart growth or new urbanism, where we're trying to sort of recapture the form that our cities used to take before the car became so prevalent. Things used to be closer within walking distance. It used to be you'd walk out your door and down the block and you go to the grocery store or the post office or the bank and not have to go very far for anything. It used to be that people could walk to work, or certainly kids could walk to school. We're trying to recreate those sorts of cities for a whole host of reasons. The auto-oriented city is not a community. And there's a lot of things that we're now finding out. This sort of conventional suburb does not provide a good environment for people to walk or bicycle or use transit or to get to school or to interact with their neighbors or any of these things. So the whole sort of smart growth community, especially in the rapidly growing communities in the suburbs, are trying to recreate an older urban form where streets are smaller and blocks are shorter and cars are, if there are cars, they're going slower and sidewalks are wider. And in our existing cities, we're trying to do things like make sure that new development goes near transit stations and that, again, things are more compact and closer together. I fully believe that this is the going to be more and more common as time goes on. And I just want to, before I expand on that, I just want to touch on one other issue. I don't know, how many of you are familiar with the fact that cities, ever since 1991, when ADA passed, are required to have ADA transition plans? Raise your hand. Okay. A small number of you. This is a requirement that's already in place. Cities are required to have ADA transition plans, and very few do. What does an ADA transition plan do? First of all, it is supposed to, by federal law, identify all of the barriers to disabled travel. Identify what the city is going to do to remove those barriers, provide a schedule for removing those barriers, earmark budget to pay for those things that remove the barriers, and assign a person who's responsible to make sure that this plan is followed through. Very few cities have this, but this is a federal law, and it's something that I think can be pushed, and very few cities even know that they're required to do this. But I can tell you, a few years ago, the city of Sacramento was sued. Somebody by the name of Barton sued them, Barton versus Sacramento, and Barton won. Sacramento is now required to spend 20% of their transportation budget for the next 30 years removing barriers to disabled travel. Now, that was done by lawsuit, and that is certainly a tool that, you know, if a city doesn't want to do it, I'd encourage you to use. But, you know, before you get to that point, I really think that cities ought to get on the ball and get their ADA transition plans in passed. There's no enforcement mechanism. Well, I shouldn't say that. The only enforcement mechanism right now is the lawsuit and people complaining to their city councils. But the city, there's no penalty in the federal law to say if a city doesn't do it, you know, you're going to get penalized. The only penalty comes in when somebody sues the city. So hopefully, you know, at least we can educate our city councils on this requirement and hope that they follow through with it. And those cities that don't are facing the prospect of a lawsuit. And it's probably not only your city council we need to work with, but perhaps a city attorney as well, because they're risk averse and they're always trying to make sure that the city doesn't get sued for one thing or another. But we can always point to Barton versus Sacramento when you're talking to the city attorney. So, last, I want to close with just a few comments about the future. I really believe that for a variety of reasons and for a variety of interest groups, we are headed in a direction of more walkable cities and communities that better accommodate visually impaired and people with other disabilities. There is a growing awareness of the needs for disability of people who are disabled. There's, as I said, this health advocacy that is gaining a lot of strength. It's trying to recreate community form. But there's a few things that are just sort of, you know, beyond our control that are happening that I think we're going to be hearing a lot more about. Peak oil is one of them. We are running out of oil. And this is not a well-known fact. I mean, but anybody can look on the U.S. Energy Administration's website and see that there's about 1.2 trillion barrels of known reserves left in the world. And at the rate we're using it, it's going to run out in about 29 years. And what does that mean? And by the way, the alternatives, they're good, and we ought to be working towards alternatives to oil and petroleum, gasoline. But they're limited as well. And I fully expect that in the next 10 years or so, the issue of peak oil, if not sooner than that, is really going to start to hit home. Another related issue is global warming. We're going to have a lot more Katrinas, and we're going to have a lot more wildfires in the West. Many environmental consequences of global warming are going to come and hit us and make it very clear to us that we cannot continue a way of life where everybody has to drive wherever they go. We're going to have to recreate communities where people can walk short distances to work, to the store, to the bank, to the doctor, to the school, and to the friends and relatives' houses. So anyhow, with that, I will close and open it for comments.
Charlene, I have a comment and a question first before I open the floor to questions. I just wanted to say, oh, and this is Rhonda King, by the way. Anyway, I just wanted to say that, you know, I come from a sighted world. Up until I was 34, I had vision. And I'm looking back and speaking about audible pedestrian signals, aka accessible pedestrian signals. I gave testimony a few years ago to the county supervisors in Sacramento related to this subject. And coming from a sighted world, I let them know because they wanted to know, you know, why do we have to have audible pedestrian signals for the blind, and is it necessary because there's other people out there saying it's not necessary because blind people can listen for when traffic stops. Well, that's not always true. But like I say, coming from a sighted world, it's not only standard practice, but it is mandatory that every intersection, is equipped with a pedestrian signal for sighted people. And they have pictures. You know, years ago it said walk, don't walk. Now they have pictures where it has a hand, a red hand showing stop. And then they have a little green figure walking to let you know that it's time to walk. So, you know, I mean, sighted people can see when traffic stops. Okay? But it's mandatory that all intersections have a pedestrian signal for sighted people. And so I told the county supervisors, it stands to reason that blind people should have that same privilege. But my question is, if technology going way back to when pedestrian signals were first invented with pictures, why can't those same pedestrian signals be equipped with sound? Why is our pedestrian signals always have to be extra equipment?
I think it's a very good question, and certainly I think every intersection can be equipped. One of the things I would encourage you all to do, since there is a variety of technology out there, is that the blind community comes together and agrees on which technology it wants at every intersection, so that if there is a standard created, that communities know which one to put in, because it's still a little bit up in the air as to which technology to use. So, but I think it's absolutely a valid point that this ought to just be a standard part of every signalized intersection.
Okay, we have just a little bit of time. We have allowed extra time for our presenter today because one of the other presenters was unable to be here, but I understand we have about three people in line for questions and
four
people. Okay. I didn't see the other one back there. Anyway. Okay, so state your name and ask your question.
Charlene Ornelas, San Diego Braille Club. Real quick, San Diego actually has a policy that is new that says all new intersections have to be presented as far as review for the appropriateness of an audible signal. And we're looking at trying to get it so that all signals, when installed, must have the capability of having audible signals added to them at some later date if that is going to be required. My question is, in talking about your refuge island and using a guide dog, my dog is taught to keep me, you know, out of the way of, you know, tripping hazards and stuff. How do you handle the island so I can find it? If it goes all the way across the crosswalk, you then have some problems with, you know, wheelchair cuts. How wide do you make it? You know, because at that point, you're going to have to make it real wide. How does that handled? And the second question I have is, in San Diego, we have some of the bulb outs, but we're having a problem with the fire department. In order to get their apparatus around those corners, they want rolled curbs, which now puts me as a blind person out in the street without knowing it.
Okay. Those are good questions. On the first one, the gap in the island has to be the same width as the crosswalk itself. And again, if we're designing crosswalks the way I suggested, with any texture to the outside, there should be enough guidance there, texture and both texture and color, to help you see where the edge of the crosswalk is, and then the gap through the island would accommodate that pretty well. On the issue of fire departments and bulb outs, it's true that fire departments are concerned about bulb outs and a lot of these other traffic calming devices and narrower streets and some of the other things I talked about. But I think, you know, we can design them with fire departments in mind, but not necessarily with rolled curbs. If we do use rolled curbs, certainly there ought to be a texture and color boundary, again, so that somebody can tell where the edge of the curb is. But I don't know. I mean, this is an ongoing discussion with new urbanists and the fire departments, because, you know, we're trying to slow traffic down. And they don't want any barriers at all. Excuse me. And so, I don't know, we're allowing them to turn into the second lane. Excuse me. All of a sudden got a dry throat.
But there's got to be an ongoing discussion with the fire department. I'm sorry.
Water.
I just lost my voice.
Water.
Boy, I don't know what happened there. I don't know. I mean, the fire truck can turn into the second lane of travel to give themselves a little bit more room. But this is going to be an ongoing issue. And I can see the day where we're trying to maybe get smaller trucks, more versatile trucks, and some other things. But there's a lot of equipment that the fire trucks are loaded down with now, and it's tough to cut back. So a discussion to be had.
I'm Joya Iru, and I live in Hemet, California, and I belong to Inland Empire, area. Recently, I was walking to the dentist, and there was just got off the bus, and I was walking down the street. Oops. I don't know how to work this thing. And I saw a sign, and it's very, very one of those horse things. And there was a fence around it, and the sign, I couldn't even read it. But I saw this fence, and I couldn't even see the fence, but it was open, it was a construction zone on the sidewalk, which I think is inappropriate, because what happens is that they do these construction things on sidewalks for people, and the people can't even see them, and I couldn't see them, and I'm really blind, and I couldn't see them, and person that's with a, and I'm supposed to have a cane pretty soon, but haven't gotten it yet. And a person that's visually handicapped cannot see these signs. Person that's a senior citizen, I'm a senior too, but a person that's blind can't see them. And they just leave them there. They don't do anything with them. They just leave them there for months and months and months and go then working on some other road. And then we have a lot of housing going up in our area, and it's the same thing. They start working on other streets and leave them and then go work in a different area, and they just leave them. They just don't do anything about them, and they put these horses on there, those little orange yellow things, and it says with lettering, and nobody can hardly read. And we don't have any, our stop signs are, flashing lights, and, you know, our signals are not any good. Nobody can read them. I mean, nobody can see them. And I try to see the curb cuts. I can't see them. I've almost got run over by a car because I don't have peripheral vision. And I don't, right now we're right in the middle of the election. They're going to have a voting on the 7th. I don't even know what to do.
Okay, Toya, do you have a question for the gentleman?
My question is there anything I could do to help do
yes.
something around in our community, even though we're having an election right now? Is there anything I could do? I mean, I'm going to try to get a whole bunch of people together, but is there anything I could do to help with these, help with these, expedite these problems?
Yeah, I think you're living in a jurisdiction which is like most that doesn't have good standards about what happens around construction sites. And so in order to change that, you need to work with your public works department, but most importantly your city council. And if you've got an election right now, I would encourage you to contact the candidates for city council and tell them this is an issue.
Okay, briefly, I think we have one or two more questions, and we're going to have to be quick about this. Okay, two more questions.
Hi, how are you? Richard Moore, Alhambra, California, San Gabriel Valley chapter. I wanted to talk to you about something that is a law of unintended consequences, which I see that you might want to address, and that is because we put in all the curb cuts, you have people riding bicycles on the sidewalk. When I grew up, which was 58 years ago, I learned to ride on the street. Now, I don't ride a bike anymore, but I feel like maybe in order to prevent getting run over, which hasn't happened yet, I should carry, instead of a cane that sometimes I do carry, I should carry a quarter staff and put it across my body this way so that I won't get run over. Don't they teach kids how to negotiate traffic properly so they can ride in the street?
Well, I think here
anymore?
We're running into our issue of complete streets again. Most kids don't receive good education as to how and where to ride bicycles. And most cities don't have good bikeways and good bike lanes and all of that so that kids are riding in the street and in the proper places. So, it's an issue that I think is addressed again with complete streets. Again, encouraging your cities to have, to think about all users, including bicycles and pedestrians in their planning.
Okay, we're going to take this one last question and... then we're going to have to move on. So who's up?
Hi, I'm Gil Johnson. I live in the San Francisco area. I happen to serve on the Bicycle and Pedestrian Advisory Committee for Alameda County. We have a half-cent sales tax that's there for 20 years, and it's supposed to go for transportation, bicycle, and pedestrian access. During this last year, Alameda County, through our committee, developed a countywide pedestrian plan, and I think it's a darn good start. There's some holes in it, but a question I have, and you might be interested in the plan yourself, but the question I have, the consultants that we hired who were writing the plan were very aware and sensitive to needs of people with disabilities as pedestrians. If they wouldn't, they knew I would yell at them. But they referred only to ADA. And I'm wondering, are there some other regulatory regulations that also talk about pedestrian access? Or are there some, best practices? As we did the research, we found that the city of Portland had put together a pedestrian plan that was, we thought, very good, and we drew from that and then added our own things as well.
Yeah. A couple of things. First, I'm aware of that plan. I bid on it and came in second. But I know the team who won it, and Gail Payne, I know, is on that team. She's very capable and very interested in these issues. It only covers unincorporated parts of Alameda County, something to keep in mind. But yes, there is something beyond ADA. There's California Title 24, although it is more concerned with buildings. And ADA is more concerned, the work that I do is more concerned with sidewalks and crosswalks, sort of the public realm. Title 24, I understand, is more in sort of the private realm. But it does affect some public locations. The U.S. Access Board is developing new standards right now. And they've got something that I guess could be called best practices. They're actually, for the past several years, they've been working on stronger regulations that they hope to pass. But certainly in the meantime, they've got some concepts that they've gathered that are sort of like best practices. And that's, again, U.S. Access Board.
Madam Chair, Barbara Rose, could I please? Just one question.
Okay, but make it brief, please.
Okay.
Because we're already into the next presenter's time.
Okay. I'm sorry, I got tied up. I went to VTA, and they had a great big... VTA is Valley Transportation Authority, and I'm on their Citizens Advisory Committee for Committee for Transit Accessibility. They built a bicycle and pedestrian walkway that did nothing for safety or for people walking. There was no signage that I couldn't tell where to go, how to go, or anything else. Unfortunately, they never came to their Committee for Transit Accessibility, and therefore we didn't get give the input. I'm now bringing it to the Committee for Transit Accessibility, but we've got to do something to be sure that everyone has full information and full access, and that bicycles, maybe they need to have a divider where bicycles could be on one side and pedestrians on the other, and you won't get knocked over by a bike, skateboards, and all the other wheel devices that could kill you.
Yeah, and what we're finding with a lot of the sort of bike paths and multi-purpose paths is that where there's a lot of traffic, it definitely works best. You know, places like Venice Beach bike path definitely works best to have a divider and sidewalk separated from the bike path.
But it's not happening.
Okay. All right. Ryan, we appreciate everything you've had to say today. You were great, and you know, it's really important for all of us, okay? If we want things to work out for us, it's all important for us to get involved, because if we don't get involved, people like Ryan Snyder can't do the work alone. And they're here for us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Thank you, Ryan. Okay, our next two presenters, which... In a moment, Jeff is going to speak briefly about one of them. But our first presenter is going to be giving us an update on blind field services. And she is currently a rehabilitation supervisor and acting program manager for Southern California. And then we're also going to be hearing from Richard DeVilder, who is the deputy director of Independent Living and External Affairs Division on disaster preparedness. And our first presenter is going to be Catherine Bales, and Jeff would like to say a few words before we bring Catherine up. Jeff?
Okay, I won't take for long. I do want to tell a brief story before I introduce Catherine. That is about Tony Candela, who I'm sure she will mention. He's not able to be here today. But Tony and I were meeting for lunch a month or two ago. And I don't know what this says about rehab, but I want all you rehab folks to listen to this and draw your own conclusions now. Tony and I were meeting for lunch, and I was about 20 minutes late because I was doing hiring interviews. So he was standing on the street corner waiting for me in his suit and tie. And a gentleman came by who was obviously down on his luck, and he came up to Tony, and he gave Tony an apple. And he said, Tony, or not Tony, but he said, sir, you must need this more than I do. So I don't know what that says, but, you know, that's for you rehab folks to figure that out. Tony, yes, what Tony did to me, he gave me the apple. Maybe because the state legislature doesn't pay anything either. I don't know what that says. I'm not going to provide a lengthy introduction of Deputy Director Richard DeVilder, because we had him here last time. And he is a second-time presenter at this convention. But I am going to introduce our other presenter, Catherine Bales. She's been in the field of vocational rehabilitation for the last 25 years, earning her bachelor's degree in education with a major in special education from Arizona State University, and a master's in education with an emphasis in rehabilitation administration from San Diego State. She served people with disabilities for the past 20 years with the Department of Rehabilitation as a counselor and supervisor. Catherine is now one of 9 rehabilitation supervisors in the Blind Field Services section, which was established largely through the efforts of CCB. Give yourselves a hand. In 2004. She supervises senior vocational rehabilitation counselors from San Diego and Southern Orange County. Catherine currently serves as an acting district administrator for Blind Field Services following the retirement of program manager Jim Armstrong. As a person who is visually impaired, Catherine is excited to be able to focus her efforts on providing quality independent living and vocational services to consumers with vision loss. And we are happy to present both Richard DeVilder and Catherine Bales.
it is my pleasure to be here with all of you. And I've had the pleasure of being with you for the past couple days. And I've learned so much. So thank you for this conference and for all that you're doing in CCB. It's wonderful, and you're helping to give a lot of future changes for people with vision loss. That will be the one program, or the one workshop that I sat in on was concerning self-driving cars, and I want to be first in line for that one. Okay. So I would like to bring greetings to you from Catherine Campisi. Catherine is doing a presentation and attending the Blind Enterprise Program, and it's a training conference going on this weekend. And in addition, Tony Candela, our deputy director, and he's in Cleveland, Ohio. So I hope they both are having a great day, and this gives me the opportunity to meet with all of you. Let me tell you just a little bit about myself. I lost the majority of my vision, all except for about 5%, and that really doesn't count for too much, except for getting me into more and more trouble, because I try to use every little speck of it, and I'm usually wrong. Anyway, so I lost that vision when I was 19. I was studying to be a nurse, and went to bed one night with that 20/20 vision that I really needed in nursing, and woke up the next morning with the vision that I have. No warning, and it was quite the surprise. Well, it changed my life, as you can imagine. But as far as I'm concerned, I've got a much better life now than I probably would have had if I had continued the way I was going. One thing also was that I was getting a lot of speeding tickets, and so it's probably a good thing I got off the road. I could never slow down. So it was through a lot of training, Illinois Visually Handicapped Institute in Chicago, and we have some people here that are very familiar with IVHI, including Ken Metz, and also Gil Johnson. So we've had a chance to talk about people that I knew there. Let me bring you up to date, though, with the Specialized Services Division of the Department of Rehabilitation. In 2003, the SB 105 brought this division into being. And I am so happy it did. I've been with the department for 20 years. I have served as a supervisor for counselors who worked with people who are blind or visually impaired. And I heard from others how difficult it was getting to be to provide quality services in some ways to people who have vision loss, because so many of the supervisors and other staff just didn't have that specialized knowledge that is so important. So now our supervisors and our counselors have specialized knowledge in working with people who are blind or visually impaired. And I'm very, very proud to be a part of this part of the division. I would like to say that the division includes, if you don't know that already, OCB, Orientation Center for the Blind, and Mike Cole is here. And it also includes BEP, the Business Enterprise Program. It includes the Deaf and Hard of Hearing administrative staff. And it includes the the Blind Field Services section, number one, okay, as far as I'm concerned. So there's several different arms of the Specialized Services Division. The one that I'm going to speak on a little bit right now is the Blind Field Services section of Specialized Services. We have a few counselors here, and a couple of them that I've met and that I know are here are Nellie Emerson. Could you stand, Nellie? Yay. Trisha Leet. Richard Burita. Those are the only ones I know about. Stand up. Terry, okay. Ed Crespin, that's right. We had dinner together on Thursday night. And Terry Almy was here too. Is she here today? Okay. Is there anybody else in the room that I just might have forgotten? Speak up and speak out. Okay. Well, I'm very, very proud to be able to work with these counselors. Every one of them has very, very dedicated to the people that they are serving. With Blindfield Services Section, we have 68 counselors, 9 supervisors. We're down to 8 right now, but I'll talk about that in a second. And we have 68 counselors. We are currently serving 5,500 consumers who are blind and visually impaired. That's quite a large number of people with varying needs and people that are just beginning because of a new sight impairment. Others have had a sight impairment for quite a while and maybe just need our services again. We have elderly people that are receiving our services because, as we know, that when people get older, very often their sight becomes impaired. I think there's an increase in people with sight impairments, number one, because as our medical field has advanced so much, people who might not have survived, whether it be from birth injuries or as they have injuries or illness, they are now surviving, but so many of them are surviving with sight impairment. So we want to be there for those people. In addition, the people who are at the other end, who are advancing in age, they are living longer and they're wanting to have quality life. They don't want to just say, well, I'm going to just sit at home now and let people take care of me. They really do want to be a part of their community and continue to be a strong member of their families. And we want to be there to help them to do that. So many of people do not realize when they first lose their vision that they will really do have opportunities to go to work. Speaking of going to work, and that's one of our main focuses along with teaching independence, going to work, we had last year, we had 362 people who went to work competitively. That was in 2005. Let me refrain from that. 2005. In 2006, however, we have 458 consumers who went to work competitively. We are very, very proud that this number is increasing. We do have a decrease in the number of people that we are serving to be what we call homemaker plans. But this isn't a bad thing. In the past, perhaps counselors might have developed a homemaker plan for people who were newly blind, and yet they were younger. They were under 55. And it was because the client, the applicant that came, wasn't at all aware that they could really go back to work. And so they said, no, no, they didn't want to go to work. Well, now we are talking to them in a different way, especially our young people. And we're encouraging them and showing them how they can indeed go to work or retain the jobs that they currently have. This is so important. So now instead of developing a homemaker plan, we're developing vocational plans. And we're showing people with blindness that they can go to work. We're offering them opportunities to get the training that might be needed. We're showing them how they can use assistive technologies to help them go to school and go to work. We're working with employers to help them understand how people with vision loss can indeed be working at their companies. We're developing partnerships, and that's so important. Partnerships within the community, partnerships with our employers. You know, I go out and give presentations to employers and other agencies all the time, and I love doing that. And one of the exercises that I do with the employers, it's called Pick a Disability. And in that, people have to decide about which disability they would most want to have and which one they would say, no way, I don't want that one. Sometimes I just plain assign them the disability they're going to have, explaining that people who do have disabilities never have the opportunity to say, one day they wake up and say, you know, I think maybe I'm going to be somebody with a wheelchair. And no, I don't ever want to be hearing impaired. We don't have that opportunity. When a disability occurs, it occurs, and it lasts for the rest of our lives. Well, when I talk with these people, the majority of the time, people do not want to have blindness. Some of the people say to me, when I say, well, why? What's wrong with having blindness? And they said, well, I wouldn't be able to do anything. Well, they're speaking to the wrong person. So what I do, usually I can get by with it pretty good. I don't let people know that I've got a vision loss when I'm giving my presentation. So when I get to that section of the presentation of talking about the different disabilities, I wait with blindness to the end. And then I let them know that I can't see any of them in the room. And what I do, and what I'm able to do, and how I've gotten my education after my vision loss. And they're amazed. Well, you know, I don't want people to be amazed, but I want them to be able to see what people with vision loss can indeed do if given the opportunity. With Blind Field Services section, that's just what we want to do. We want to reach out to our consumers. We want to reach out and help them to develop the careers that they want to have that are realistic, of course. I've had a couple that really want to be, what would it be that blind people can't do? You know what? I can't think of too many things except that taxi driver, truck driver, pilot. Okay, so those are a few things that they probably can't do. But for the most part, if they have the capability, if they have the motivation, if they follow through with their training, with getting the kinds of grades that they need to have in school, if they want to be an outstanding employee, because who wouldn't want to be, then they too can have a fulfilling, oops, I'm sorry, that's my little scooter. I forgot to turn it off. At any rate, they will be able to get jobs that are fulfilling. They can become full members of our community. And that's what we want to continue to do. I want to thank CCB for the cooperative spirit it's had with the Department of Rehabilitation. We are working together to make sure that assistive technologies are available for our clients, for our employees. We are making sure that customer service is there. And I'm happy to say that Freedom Scientific and HumanWare are really trying to come on board. They want to provide the type of technical support, the type of customer service that we really do need to have, that our applicants, our clients need to have, that our employees need to have as well. So thank you to HumanWare. I was so glad to be at the presentation last night and listen to, oh my goodness, how did I do that? I forgot his name just like that. It's called Age. right, Richard. And I had met him before too. So I'm very happy that he took the time to come from New Zealand to speak with all of you. I use these assistive technologies, I know how important they are. They help me to do my job much more effectively than I wasn't if I wasn't able to. I want to thank also Kathy Skivers. Kathy is a strong part of the Business Advisory Committee, and our next meeting is going to be November 9th, and I hope to see her there. I plan to be there. I want to thank everyone here at CCB for all the work that you're doing. We really do have to continue to work together. We really do have to keep these partnerships going. And I want you to be able to tell us, what do you need? How can we help? If we can't help, we want to find out why. We want to find out how we can make things better. And so please contact us. Right now, as I'm the acting program manager, and the part that we have three of us that are taking different roles in this part because of Jim Armstrong retiring. I'm not quite sure who gave him permission to retire, because I miss him dearly. But one of the areas that he said I should work on, and that's been my responsibility now, is concerning complaints and appeals. And that's for the whole state. And it's been very interesting, and I've learned a lot just in these past couple months. But you know what? If we can just sit down and talk, if we can just find out what is the real problem, how can we get together, how can we talk with one another and try to brainstorm the right solutions to all of these different problems, whatever they might be, I think we'll do a lot better. I just want to thank all of you, and I want to thank Jeff Tom for having me here, and also Ann Kaiser. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Catherine. And we're going to save questions for after the time that Richard DeVilder is done, and then we'll take a few questions, and then we'll be bringing up our next presenter. So let's hear from Richard DeVilder now. Richard?
Well, thank you, and good afternoon. Can you all hear me okay? Mic's in a good place. Excellent. I want to first off start by saying congratulations to you all for the passage of SB 1451. In my role at the department, even though on state statute we don't have a role as first responders in emergency preparedness or any emergencies, I've taken on a role as a point person for the Governor's Office of Emergency Services and the Office of Homeland Security, specifically to advise them on disability issues and preparing for disasters. And secondly, I sit in the State Operations Center during declared events to inform them and ask questions throughout the disaster to ensure that they're thinking about the issues and the needs of people with disabilities during the event, anywhere from evacuations to sheltering and so forth. What I wanted to do is give you an update as to where we are with SB 1451. With this passage. It goes into law effectively January 1st of 2007. And so we internally within the administration have been, we've had two meetings to talk about the direction and the steps that we need to take to ensure that California is in compliance with SB 1451 as early as possible. So what I can share with you at this point is we are currently developing a process to ensure that there's an inclusive nomination for individuals from the community to serve on the committees. And let me explain the committees to you. Under the Governor's Office of Emergency Services, they have what's called SEMS, which is a Standardized Emergency Management System. And under SEMS, there are technical committees. And the technical committees focus on certain things. Sometimes they're long-term committees, sometimes they're short-term committees, dependent on what the technical issue is that they're dealing with. What was put in SB 1451 is that anything dealing with evacuations, sheltering, and communications, and any other pertinent committees, the director of the Office of Emergency Services is to select three disability representative seats on each of those technical committees. So the way that works is, I said to them, what does it mean pertinent? And I think we found a pertinent committee, even now. And for example, the Volunteer Service Corps, State Service Corps, came to us in the meeting and said, well, we have a committee regarding all the different volunteer programs throughout the state that assist during disasters, and we'd like to have 3 seats on that committee, even though that committee wasn't one that was written into the bill, but it fell under the category of pertinent committees. And so what we'll be doing is working with them to be able to find seats. The seats are defined as person with who's visually impaired or blind, a person who has a cognitive or sensory disability, and the third seat is a person with a physical disability. So what we will be doing is sending out nomination packets, and you all will get, your representatives will get that information to send out to the group, and we will send that out to all the different departments in the state and all the community-based organizations in the state. And what we decided to do is we will have those of us from the different departments, such as rehabilitation, the Department of Developmental Services, all the different departments like social services that represent or serve people with disabilities, will be advising the Governor's Office of Emergency Services on those applications that come in as to who needs to sit on the different seats. Because remember, you're not talking about just 3 people. You're talking about 3 people for each committee. To that. Right now, we estimate there's about 4 or 5 committees that currently exist that will fall under SB 1451 law. So our goal is to have those seats filled by sometime in March of 2007. And so you should be looking for, and we'll make sure you all get it, but there should be packets going out to the community by probably early December to mid-December to start the selection process, and you'll probably have about 4 or 5 weeks to get those applications in so that we can ensure that people are sitting in those seats as soon as possible. So that was a great bill that you all were able to move forward with Senator Kehoe. And I think it's very important, as I've said in the whole issue of preparing and responding to disasters, is we've got to take certain steps to get to that point. And one of the steps was getting people with disabilities into the systems where decisions are being made about us in terms of the process of preparing for emergencies. So you should be looking for that information to be coming forward very soon to you. Some other things that are going on in terms of emergency preparedness in the state is each state department is required to submit a plan to the Governor's Office of Emergency Services, and they refer to it as COOP and COG. And COOP and COG basically is the continuity of operations. And the Governor's Office has stated to all the departments that they want the departments to submit a plan to ensure that we will be able to bring up services as quickly as possible and also be able to assist during a disaster with our employees, with maybe accessing some of our community-based organizations to assist in disasters. So what we're currently doing is developing a plan, and some of you probably know Joe Xavier from our department, and Joe Xavier is responsible in our department for developing that plan. All state departments are required to submit a plan, and what will happen is they will be melding those plans together to ensure that the state has a solid plan in place to assist during disasters and to bring up the operations of the department as quickly as possible after a disaster. Now, obviously, there are a lot of factors that go into bringing up services right away, but what we wanted to ensure is that there are also alternate facilities and places identified, alternate ways to provide services to individuals who are consumers of our department and of other departments to just ensure that we lessen the gap as best possible during events and, you know, during disasters. So I think with that, I like to take a lot of questions, so why don't we go ahead and do that.
Okay, we have time for a few questions, and state your name and who are you going to be addressing your question to?
Question, can you, even you're probably need to hear me, maybe you could repeat it. You mentioned that there was a fourth group that wanted to be included that had not been. I didn't quite understand who they were. I'd like to know who they are. And I'd like to know, as the bill was being developed, that they came and asked to be included.
I think that question's to me.
Yes.
Okay. And she's asking about the fourth group or committee that I mentioned in regards to the emergency preparedness and the technical committees. What it is in the state we have a group called the California Service Corps. And the California Service Corps are basically a group of volunteers in different types of groups, anywhere from law enforcement to your basic community volunteer groups, which the California Service Corps provides some oversight and technical assistance to. They have a committee, and they have a section in the California Service Corps that's specifically designed around emergency preparedness. And so what they have asked is that that committee, which is through the California Service Corps, also includes the three representative seat, disability representative seats on their committee. Does that answer your question? You're welcome.
My name is Charlene Ornelas. I'm with the San Diego Braille Club. My question is, in the emergency preparedness trainings that they go through, of having people that really have a disability involved in those trainings. I was involved in one at San Diego State and found that there was a real lack of people understanding it. When you have somebody who is pretending to be disabled, first, they don't know all of what it is like and what the needs are of a person with a disability, and two, they're real quick to just be asked to and cooperate with, get out of the wheelchair, and, you know, because I don't know how to transfer you. I snuck my daughter and myself into it because I have connections and did not tell them that I was disabled until I was told my name was on the list and then informed, and by the way, I am, and so is my daughter. But my daughter, who is a full-time wheelchair user, she cannot stand and walk really, was asked in the event to get out of her wheelchair and transfer to a cot. She told them she couldn't. They said, well, why not? She says, it's for real. I can't do it. So it's really important to, and I realize there's some risk involved because, you know, you are simulating an injury. There are, you know, debris there, you know, we had glass and everything else around us, but I was also didn't have my dog at the time, but I was separated from my cane and immediately told him I needed it. I was told we'll get it to you later, and later was very difficult to get my cane. I fortunately had some very good paramedics with me, and eventually they looked for it. I would have never found it.
I'll say a big amen to your comments. And one of the things that we're doing in the state through our department specifically is we are having conversations with the Governor's Office of Emergency Services specifically around training. The Office of Emergency Services has an academy, and they also provide training throughout the state. An example of the training that's going on and some of the issues that they have to deal with is when trainings are given through the different Office of Emergency Services, there are oftentimes specific federal training programs that they are supposed to be using, but it doesn't mean that they can't add on to those training programs or integrate disability more into the programs that currently exist. So we are actually going to be meeting with his name is Rich Robles, and he is the coordinator of training for the Office of Emergency Services. And one of the things that we've said to him is that we are very concerned that there are not people with disabilities providing the training or even providing the feedback as to the curriculum and what goes on in those trainings for first responders and for community-based organizations that are assigned to assist people with people during events. So yes, we agree with you, and we are trying to move forward with Office of Emergency Services and also the Office of Homeland Security to specifically address that issue. One of the things that I would say to you all is it's very important for you all to get involved in your local community, your local counties and your local cities that do planning, and say, I want to be a part of the training and I want to be a part of the planning that you're providing in this community during the, specifically to emergency preparedness and response. They need to start hearing from us all in the community. They need to see that we all exist. And that we are all at the level and we have the intelligence and the skills and the ability to assist them to do good things and to start addressing many of the issues of emergency preparedness and response.
Yeah.
Okay, we have time for one more question, and then after that question, I'm going to ask all of you something. So just one more question, please.
Okay.
Just one.
Hi, Rhonda. This is Jerry Arakawa, and as all of you, or most of you know, I work in the department as a rehab supervisor in the Employment Preparation Service. And I know this comes up from time to time with this body. Those of you who are clients of the Department of Rehabilitation and are interested in working in the field of social service, the department has changed criteria for working as a rehabilitation counselor considerably in the last year. It's essentially mandatory to have a master's degree in rehabilitation or a related field that will allow you. You don't have to have a certified rehabilitation counseling license, but you should be able, if necessary, you should have some theory classes or a couple of counseling classes that would allow you to sit for the CRC. That's not particularly why I mentioned this. I mentioned this issue because it's anticipated that many positions will come available in the next few years in rehabilitation. And I know our director has been very involved in visiting the college campuses that offer master's degrees in rehab. And because we are always looking for good, committed, capable employees interested in working to make the department the best it can be, I would urge all of you who are clients and would be clients to think about rehab, to start the master's program, to start your college program, ending up with a master's in rehab, and join us in the department.
Thank you, Jerry.
I couldn't agree more. Thank you, Jerry.
Okay, I understand that Barbara Rhodes was actually in line before Jerry, so we're going to allow a brief.
I can't be brief, I'm sorry.
Okay, is it a question?
Rhonda says so.
No, I know, Rhonda. Thank you.
Okay.
I'm Barbara Rhodes. I'm very involved with my community in transportation at both the... I'm short. At the county level and also at the regional level. I'm very concerned that there is not more planning at that level, and I am involved and I am advocating for this and have been advocating it for a number of years to have transportation set up so that in case of an earthquake or in case of a flood or whatever, some disaster, that there things are in place. Unfortunately, so many, and I'm going to sound prejudiced now, but they are the sighted people think they know what's best for us, and they really don't understand our needs, and they don't want to ask us for it. And I'm really, really concerned.
Yeah, you bring up a very important and very critical point, and I think your point is something that we saw horrifying in Hurricane Katrina. And let me tell you what we've done in the last year in terms of trying to move forward on this. And I'll be blunt and say to you that I'm very frustrated as to the lack of progress that we've had, and it's not due to a lack of effort on our part in our department. What we have done is we've submitted recommendations to the Governor's Office of Emergency Services, specifically around evacuations of people with disabilities. And the focus is around the issue of fires and earthquakes and being prepared and knowing how to assist. There's always this opinion in the world or the industry of emergency preparedness and response that there needs to be a registry of people with disabilities. And I'm of a different opinion.
And elderly.
Hold on. I'm of a different opinion. And my opinion is this. Those registries already exist within the services that are being provided in the community by the different organizations and by the paratransits that are being paid to provide services for us. And so what we've done in terms of our recommendations is around bringing those groups to the table, including aging and senior centers and so forth, who provide transportation services, to the planning table at the local level, to ensure that they are a part of the planning. In emergency preparedness, you have this thing called mutual aid agreements. And mutual aid agreements are basically the different folks within your local area that are part of the emergency response and recovery system. The disability services field has not been a part of those mutual aid agreements and are not a part of the planning that goes through. In the last 3 weeks, I've spoken at two Caltrans conferences, and the specific reason why I was at those Caltrans conferences was to speak to those who are running the mass transits in the counties and in the cities, and who are also running the paratransit programs, to meet with them and talk to them about the recommendations and the things that they need to start doing to address the issue. And as I always say to them, you're only one disaster away from being a Hurricane Katrina. And I provided for them in my presentation testimony that occurred at a hearing before Congress in November of 2005. And in that testimony, there was testimony about a lady who was a quadriplegic who tried for two solid days and called people who, quote-unquote, are in the field and are, quote-unquote, important people to get a ride. They found her 5 days later dead, floating next to her wheelchair.
Oh, my God.
So that brings it home to the fact that they had paratransit as part of it. And I know that in a flood, we're not going to send paratransit vehicles out necessarily to get people. But we know through the databases that they have and the other services like in-home supported services, we know where people live. And we have the ability to use satellite to find where addresses are located on a map and in a community. And first responders and those who are planners need to get off their seats, and they need to start addressing it seriously in that manner.
Right. But we also have regional transportation cards, and there's seniors groups. I mean, there are so many that aren't all using paratransit. They're using fixed route. The buses have wheelchair lifts and stuff like that.
Yes, we've
all that has to be part of it.
We've included all that in the recommendations. It's all part of it.
Thank you very much. Now I have one question.
Thank you, Barbara.
Catherine,
thank you,
quick.
Barbara.
No, what?
No.
Thank you, Barbara.
I'm sorry.
Okay,
you can talk to me later.
First off, I want to thank Catherine Bales and Richard DeVilder for being here with us today. Secondly, I'm going to ask everybody here a question, and if the answer is no, then I want you to ask yourself why. I do this at every convention. When you go to your rooms, when you're escorted to your rooms, when you go to the convention, do you ever ask your escort to show you where the stairwell is in case of an emergency?
Yes.
Okay, if the answer is no, then you need to ask yourself why. Because if we're all concerned about disaster preparedness, this is part of it. We're going to be hearing now from the director of the National Employment Center for the American Foundation for the Blind. And his topic today is employment as it is and as it should be. So let's please welcome Mr. Gil Johnson.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah.
Great. Yeah. I asked Jeff Tom if we could lock the door so that, you know, we'd have a full audience, but he wouldn't agree to that. But I hope the topic will hold your interest. I've prepared an outline. I'm going to move it along as quickly as I can because I know you've been sitting for a long time. But I want to just say my appreciations for the invitation to come and speak here. It's been several years since I've been here. I think the last time was when we were in the throes of SB 105 negotiation. I came and spoke at one of your conferences. We know the outcome of that, so maybe that's a good track record to follow. What I wanted to start with, though, is a little bit on the lighter side. I happen to like to collect writings and things that people send me. You know, you get stuff over the email. Most of it's junk, but there's a few that are keepers. And somebody a while back sent me a few quotes from The Wisdom of Will Rogers. And I happen to be a fan of Will Rogers. I wish we had a current one. But one of them that I liked that I saw that I thought was pretty interesting is, letting the cat out of the bag is easier than putting it back in. And another one that those of you who live in kind of rural areas or come from that background would appreciate this. If if you find yourself in a hole, stop digging. And finally, after eating an entire bull, a mountain lion felt so good that he just started roaring. And he kept up roaring until a hunter came along and shot him. The moral? If you're full of bull, keep your mouth shut. Well, you can see why Will Rogers is a fan. I'm a fan of Will Rogers. What I want to talk to you about today is I have kind of 5 points that I want to touch on. I want to talk about what I believe we would all agree to as a goal for employment of blind and visually impaired people. I'd like to talk about the current status, talk a little bit about barriers, what I believe to be some positive indicators, and two recommendations, Jeff and others on the board, that I have, what I'd like to present to CCB for action. So I think we would probably all pretty much agree that a goal that we would like to achieve for employment of blind and visually impaired people is for the percentage of people who are employed to be equivalent or equal to that percentage in the general population. I didn't think there'd be any disagreement on that. You know, if we can come close to 5% of full employment, we're pretty darn good. Unfortunately, this gets to my second point of where do we stand right now. And I hasten to say that these statistics are far from as current as we need, and they're certainly open to question. But it does, what I'm about to reference here, comes from the National Center for Health Statistics. This stuff is on our website, by the way, afb.org, so you can verify for yourself that I didn't make it up. But this is 1994-95 data, and that's, you know, already 11 years old. But it's the best we have. So the employment rate, As this information would show it, of blind and visually impaired people, blind and visually impaired, now that's not just legally blind, is 40 to 45%, or 1.7 million. Well, I'm sorry, 1.3 million. The converse of that, of course, is that the unemployment is 1.7 million, or 55 to 60%. Now, the figure that we most commonly toss around, I think, is the employment rate, or turn it around to the negative side, the unemployment rate of legally blind persons is at about 30%, or 160,000. That's not a lot of people. And so, we have a lot to do. Unfortunately, you know, what we see in the blindness field is also true for people with other disabilities. There was a very extensive amount of research done in 2001-2002 by folks at Cornell, and this was not specific to blind or visually impaired people. It was people with disabilities in general. Very carefully done work, and what they found was that while the employment rate, and this was in the 90s, during the boom years of the 90s, while the employment rate for the general population was on the increase, for people with disabilities it was in decline. And they spent a lot of their analysis trying to understand why, where does that come from, and there's still some debate about that. But everyone seems to agree that all the indicators are that in spite of everything that's going on, the employment rate for people with disabilities in general has declined over the last 15 years. One specific indication of that, some information I saw just a few days ago, employment in the federal government. Kathy, they need you back. The employment rate percentage for, again, this is people with all disabilities in the federal government, has dropped over the last several years, currently at about 24,000 or 1% of the number of federal employees are people with disabilities. Again, nobody really quite knows why, and the EEOC is going to be putting on quite a campaign to recruit people for employment in the federal government. So there's some employment opportunities there. One final point on where our current status that I would comment on is the Society for Human Resource Management. These are our HR managers for corporations, large, mostly large, but some medium-sized as well, get together, and they you know, have public meetings, and they talk. And they are finding that the companies that are recruiting and hiring people from high school for jobs, and this is not disabled people, just anybody, the educational level, the basic skill level in reading, writing, and math is far below what employers need. And what industry is having to do is to recruit and hire and then put on training programs for basic educational skills that people should have gotten when they're in school. And I'm going to come back to that because I think that's really indicting of the whole educational system, and it certainly is true, I believe, for people who are blind or visually impaired. So what are the barriers? Well, you know, we could, if we had flip charts, we could list them all day and all night. In 1995, AFB convened what we call the National Summit on Employment. And there were a couple of people from ACB that were participants in that, as well as people from industry, from government. We had about 25 people, spent about 3 days, tried to identify what are those factors that are impacting employment of blind and visually impaired people. Unfortunately, it doesn't appear that what we found there, we identified 10 issues. We tried to, you know, consolidate as much as we could. Some internal, what we would call internal factors to the field of blindness, some are external. And looking at some of the research that Mississippi State University has done over the years on barriers to employment, it hasn't changed. It's the usual stuff that you read about. It's certainly employers' unawareness of the needs and capabilities of blind folks. But I like to flip that over, and I think it also says that blind and visually impaired job seekers are not as aware of the needs of employers as they need to be. If you go out and apply for a job, and if you don't understand the corporate culture, what their needs are, the communications have started off wrong right away. Other areas is certainly the preparation of job seekers, and here I would reference the preparation of high school students, as well as some of the pre-vocational training that is available. It's pretty good training in Braille, cane, computers, and so forth. It's not what it should be, but it's not too bad. But certainly transition is not going well. Public attitude, and I'm going to comment about that in a little bit. Work disincentives, we've talked about that a whole bunch. Access to information through technology, and particularly there, the cost of technology and the availability of training. Low expectations of blind and visually impaired persons themselves. That's an ongoing one. We all know that if someone loses vision in later life, or they grow up in a family where there's no expectation that they can do anything, that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, unfortunately. and that's still with us. Lack of training and a shortage, I think, this is a pretty important one, a shortage of trained, qualified rehabilitation personnel who understand the needs of blindness. Well, it ain't all negative. It ain't all on the downside, I don't think. I think there's some positive signs. And let me just talk a little bit about what I think some of them are. Certainly in California, SB 105 has been a major step. And all of you at CCB should be darn proud the role that CCB took in making that legislation happen. You bet. Give yourselves a big hand. I tell you, without Kathy Skivers and Jeff Tom and Dan Kaiser and some others at CCB, and a couple at NFB, I have to give that credit to Jim Willows particularly, SB 105 wouldn't have happened. And it did. You heard today from Kathy Bales that this year there was an increase in employment of blind and visually impaired people that the department has helped with to 458, an increase of 15%. That's darn good. Is it good enough? Heck no. It's not. My calculation is that we're about halfway to where we ought to be. And I base that on this. If we have 68 counselors, the national average for placements by rehab counselors is about 15. Just simple math says we need to be placing about 900 people in employment. We're about halfway there. So while it's good, and SB 105, I think, has made some real difference and will continue to make a difference under the leadership of Catherine Campisi and Tony Candela and others, we ain't there yet, folks. Another positive indicator, and this one may strike you as odd, but it's the huge number of baby boomers that are going to be retiring out of the workforce. And what that is going to mean is that employers are going to find it very hard to find qualified, capable employees. Is that a window of opportunity for us? You bet it is, and we ought to be jumping through that window as quickly as we can. I think that's everything I read from the employment journals and Society of Human Resource Managers is saying, look out, employers, you're going to have a harder and harder time to find qualified employees who want to work. And we can all cite personal examples of that, I'm sure. The ADA, you know, I guess it is a positive force. It certainly has been around, and employers know about it. I put it on the positive side. Strengthening of Section 508. Section 508 is a section of the Rehabilitation Act, National Rehabilitation Act, that requires the federal government must purchase equipment that can be made accessible to people with disabilities. They aren't there yet, God knows it, but there are a lot of people putting a lot of pressure on the federal government to come closer to complying with this regulation. And that's not only important for federal employees, it also has been used very successfully in leveraging negotiations with Microsoft and other companies for the federal government to say, we're not going to purchase from you unless you make your products accessible. And so it has a tremendous leveraging effect as well. And there's strong work going on to strengthen that. As I see it, another really good positive thing is the range and kinds of jobs that blind people are performing. And there, we have a database. The American Foundation for the Blind has a database called Career Connect. And we have over 1,000 blind and visually impaired people who are employed who've agreed to be mentors. and they represent something like 300 to 350 different occupations. But let me just give you an example of some that I didn't know were in there. A prison librarian. I don't know much about what that person does, but they work in the prison. They run a library. They check out books. An oceanographer. A professional dancer. A docent. And an interior decorator. I'll get that right. And those are just a few that I happen to pull out of the database. If you have some interest, we have a section in the Career Connect section on our database called Success Stories. And these are pieces, writings that people we've asked to write about what they do. And it's very inspiring to read that. And I would just encourage you all to go take a look at it. It's great stuff. And if you want to get motivated and work with people who are job seekers to think big, this is a good way to do it. There was a process going, a project going on that I was involved with, and I won't spend any time to tell you the details, but it was there's a publication coming out talking about the VR employer network. And this is a way of trying to link vocational rehabilitation and employers in a more positive kind of way. If you'd like, afterwards, I can talk to some of you about that. Improve public attitude. And I happen to be one of those that believe that even though there's some negative stuff that goes on, by and large, I think the public attitude about blindness and visual impairment is far more positive, far better than it used to be. You just travel around, and the kind of respect that you get is, I think, much, much better. The effort of the EEOC to expand employment and federal employment. And the Social Security Administration just recently published a thing called Disability System for the 21st Century. It's heavy reading, but what they're trying to do is to get at work disincentives within the Social Security system. They know and understand they're there. And it is really a major effort to try to realign the Social Security system so that it encourages people to go to work, not to keep them from it. So finally, my recommendations for CCB, if you want to think about an employment agenda for the next couple of years, and I hope you do, here's what I have three suggestions of things that I would personally like to see CCB take on, and to the extent that I can, I'd be happy to work with you to work on that. First of all, continue to monitor the Division of Blind Services. Like I said, it's a great thing. We've made some strides. We're not there yet. Kathy Skybers is co-chair of the Blind Advisory Committee. Rhonda is on the committee as well, and they are vocal, constantly raising questions for the department. And I think that's a very proper role for the consumer organization to play. And your two representatives on the council do it well. Continue with that effort. Second, I would really like to see a well-thought-through greater emphasis on transition. I think some of the work that Richard Ruida has done in the last... Richard, are you in the room? Too bad. Some of the work that he's done in the last year and a half in the area of transition has been very good. There's a lot more that needs to be done. Some of it at the policy level and working with the Department of Education, of course. But I think some real effort there. And finally, I think that there has to be a lot of work done to help job seekers understand the corporate culture. I have worked enough in my last 5 or 6 years with companies to understand that there is a disconnect between what we in rehabilitation talk about and what employers talk about. And I don't think a lot of it is is ill-intended. There's very different priorities, very different language, and I just think that we as job seekers need to understand that better. So those are my suggestions, my recommendations, and finally, let me just close on a somewhat personal note. I know that some of you know that about 6 months ago, my daughter died, and that her three children, our three grandchildren, were living with us and her. My wife and I are now guardians of a 10-year-old and twins that are 8. And I mentioned that only because it's kind of changed my life, I can tell you that. I'm all boys, prepubescents, all that, yes. The support and notes and personal support that I got from members of CCB who are colleagues, friends of mine, were very important to us. I can just say that we got many notes and messages from people in this audience and people outside this audience as well. Jeff Tom came to the celebration of life ceremony that we had for my daughter, and I was pleased that he was careful, kind enough, thoughtful enough to do that. And I just want to express my appreciation for that kind of support and thoughtfulness that so many of you extended to my wife and myself during a pretty tough period in our lives. So with that, I thank you very much for having me here, and I take questions.
Thank you, Gil. Well, it's about 4:10, and if anybody has any questions, we're not going to take more than one or two because we have other meetings we need to get to. So are there any questions for Gil? Okay, one comment. And who is this? Yeah. Okay, yeah. I think it's Barbara Rhodes, and I'm not going to ask her to be brief.
Barbara Ryder.
Oh, okay. Oh, sorry. Sorry, Barbara.
Rhonda, please meet
yes.
Barbara Ryder.
Barbara Ryder.
Ryder, Rhonda, not Barbara.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. Here's the mic. Oh, thanks. Oh, this right in. Okay. The thing that I wanted to say, I've been listening to this speech, and I find it interesting. And you were mentioning about the problems with the job seekers. Well, I think that there is a problem that way, but I think the thing we need to look at is when you're seeking a job, and I'm in the workforce, I've been on a job hunt, I know this, but there's, I think, a right way and there's a wrong way to talk about things when you're seeking and you're on that interview. How does it look if you are, for example, a computer expert, everything's fine, you know your JAWS, your deck talk and everything, but you walk in there and say, I need to get a ride. I don't know how I'm going to do this, and have a needy voice and go into this that way. Doesn't make for being popular on the job, I don't think.
I couldn't agree with you more. The employer, first of all, the employer cannot ask about how are you going to get to work, how are you going to get around, where are you going to know where the bathroom is. They cannot ask those things. They shouldn't ask those things anyway. And we shouldn't bring them up. Our challenge is to solve those problems. And that's what you and your rehabilitation counselor or your family, whoever you're working with, needs to understand that those are your problems, not the employer's problems. The employer wants you to be there to perform a job. And how you do that, how you get there, is none of his business or her business. Now, as an individual, they may say, they may be able to offer some suggestions, carpooling, putting up a notice on the bulletin board. All kinds of ways like that. But the basic issue is the job seekers. Thank you for raising that point.
You're welcome, Gil.
Okay. So, again, we want to thank Gil Johnson for being here and speaking to us today. And I want to thank you for bearing with me and my first time at presiding over a general session. I enjoyed it. Okay, so I guess that concludes our third general session this afternoon. Thank you very much. Come on, Bonnie.